Everybody on tape? Good. You're taping right now? All right.
From Seattle, the Earth on the Air Radio Works presents Earth on the Air.
That's how it is out here.
In the next half hour, Earth on the Air's grassroots contributors look at some of the causes and consequences of modern war and some of the peacemaking efforts of ordinary citizens.
We'll visit a Florida summer camp that teaches teens to be conflict mediators.
Native Hawaiians struggle to convert a missile base into a non-military oceanic research center that would bring meaningful new jobs to their island.
Author Jack Nelson Pallmeyer talks about hidden wars and strategies of low-intensity conflict.
Fallout from the Persian Gulf War.
From Los Angeles, notes of a cultural terrorist.
Thoughts from the streets, and more.
First, grassroots organizers in rural North Carolina strive to bring poor and working class people into the peace and justice movement. The tape was submitted by North Carolina's Piedmont Peace Project and Suzanne Tedesco.
My father was a tenant farmer and a mill worker. We grew up in a teeny little trailer with no bathroom or water. Well, we just grew up really poor.
Linda Stout is founder of the Piedmont Peace Project.
We work in a large rural area. It's the size of the state of Massachusetts. Most of our members are either very small subsistence farmers or mill workers. It's also a very religious area, more often referred to as the buckle of the Bible Belt. And it's an area where the Ku Klux Klan is very strong. I always cared about issues of social justice and got involved in working to start a peace group out in Charleston, South Carolina. And at some level, I knew that I was always more effective in bringing people in to the group, but it was more working class people who never stuck it out. They never stuck it out because of the classism in the organization of the peace movement. And then I went into community organizing, which is working with low income people, but I always had this commitment to the peace side of it. And at that point, there was never any connecting of those issues. The community organizers working on community issues and the peace organizers were totally different groups. It was impossible for me in my mind to separate it.
We're sitting here in the desert. We're about, 30 kilometers from Iraq, Kuwait, whatever.
Eating pistachios.
Eating pistachio nuts.
The Gulf War impacted us significantly because Piedmont Peace Project had approximately, over 500 people who were in the Middle East. And so we started early on in trying to stop it, and by January 1st had put out a video which went out all over the country.
Hi, I'm George Friday and I'm part of the Piedmont Peace Project. We are textile workers and farmers, construction workers, truck drivers, domestics, black and white
people. Working class people were the most affected by this war because that's who was fighting the war. So we organized silent coffee breaks for peace. Every employee would have these silent coffee breaks for peace. What happened around that was that several of our members were truck drivers. And they started taking these flyers out to the places they were delivering goods to, the other factories in other parts of the country. And they started talking to other truck drivers on the CB radio. To all of a sudden, before we knew it, like overnight, we had this nationwide organized effort through truck drivers. And we had major impact on change in local issues as well as national. Our congressperson sits on Defense Appropriations Committee, so he's very important. And we changed his voting record on peace issues from 0%, as rated by the Council for a Livable World in 1983, to 86%. At the same time, we've changed his voting records on social justice issues like housing and health care. We got really smart about who he was, what he was interested in, where he hung out. You know, we knew he liked to go to Shoney's with his campaign manager on Saturday mornings. We knew everything about him. And then we went after him, basically, and we talked to him from what his interest was in. at the same time, we knew that he wasn't going to listen to us with, because we didn't have any power. So we knew we had to build a base of power in the district. And we did that through nonpartisan voter registration and get out the vote, primarily in the black community.
Go up and knock at the door politely and say to them, we would like for you to get out and go vote for my what, future.
Hello, how are you?
Fine.
Have you registered to vote?
Yes, I have.
Would you please vote for my future?
Sure.
Piedmont Peace Project is developing a national training program to teach organizing skills to low-income people and outreach skills, including racism and classism awareness, to middle-class groups who'd like to build coalitions.
The middle-class peace movement is not going to win by itself, just as low-income people are not going to win by themselves. We've got to do that hard work of learning how to work with each other in order to change anything.
That was Mark Wise on the harmonica. 60 Gunner extraordinaire.
I said it's been a long, long time.
There is, I think, a sense across the country this morning of gratitude that, that no casualties have been reported. But
we have no argument with the people of Iraq.
The Allied forces are continuing what appears to be precision bombing on strategic buildings.
The Allied bombing of the electrical power plants within the first couple days of the war led to the inability to function of the water and the sewage, and that has led to waterborne diseases.
The oil well fires, the oil spills, the contamination from bombing is extensive.
Malnutrition is extremely high.
The oil spill in the Persian Gulf was the largest in the history of the world. It was about 25 times larger than the Exxon Valdez spill.
About 900,000 children under five are on the brink of starvation.
One statistic I heard from the Worldwide Fund for Nature estimated that 52 bird species had been made extinct from the oil spills in the Gulf.
So in addition to malnutrition, the main reasons for the increase in child mortality that we found was the incidence of disease.
10 to 100,000 bird deaths,
mostly cholera,
several species of dolphin,
typhoid,
a rare species of porpoise,
gastroenteritis,
shrimp.
There's also hepatitis B now.
Some of the microorganisms that make up the basis of the food chain in the Gulf.
And meningitis throughout the South.
Having defeated Iraq in the war and having an ongoing access to oil from the Persian Gulf region, we are essentially assuring that we can continue our national addiction to the use of fossil fuels, but also being willing to run the other environmental risks like acid rain, global warming, and other pollution related to the use of oil.
That piece was from tape submitted by French teacher Jean-Paul Bardou. He spoke with human rights attorney Julia Devon and Greenpeace's Cynthia Rust.
If I don't make it, just wish me luck, okay?
Is war inevitable? Is it a necessary aspect of human nature?
Definitely. We brought a little bit of the Neanderthal with us. You know, it's like genetically in us.
We could overcome war if everyone was just educated on all cultures.
It's inevitable at the stage that we're in. There's such a large discrepancy between the conditions in which people in various places in the world are living, and there's so much injustice inherent in the way the resources are divided up.
One of the tragic jokes from our leaders is that the Cold War is over and we won.
Jack Nelson Pallmeyer is the author of Brave New World Order.
The Cold War is over and the Soviet Union lost and we lost. The only way you could talk about the U.S. winning is if you considered the Cold War to be two heavyweight boxers fighting it out, and much of their fight taking place outside the ring. They stumble outside the ring and crush innocent bystanders in Central America and other places. And eventually the Soviet Union fighter dies and the U.S. fighter ends up with severe internal bleeding, and you don't know whether or not that fighter will recover. I think it's important to look at both the why the U.S. has been at war and many of them undeclared wars. And I think we could trace that from the end of World War II, in which the U.S. was essentially the only major power that was strengthened by the war. All the other countries were crippled by World War II in one way or another. And in that aftermath, I have a wonderful quote from George Kennan, who at the time was heading the State Department's planning staff. He was a very powerful voice in shaping U.S. policy. This was about 1948, in which he essentially looked at the world and says, we have 6% of the world's people, but we're consuming half of its resources. And if we're to maintain that disparity, we're going to have to do away with any ideas of spreading democracy or human rights. We're going to have to let straight power politics dominate our policies. And I think it basically, the United States, since World War II, has tried to design a world order in which, in particularly, relationships with the Third World was designed to maintain that disparity between the rich and the poor. That's the essential component in understanding U.S. warfare over the last number of decades, is the whole strategy of low-intensity conflict is to try to have low-visibility warfare in terms of the U.S. people. And the ideas behind it were fairly simple, that the lessons were learned by the U.S. military and leaders that out of Vietnam, that you couldn't have a lot of U.S. people coming back in body bags. And so the idea was basically to get other people to do the dying in wars. And so we provide the arms, we provide training, we provide guidance, but we tried to minimize the use, the long-term, at least, introduction of U.S. troops into a conflict. The other lessons that were learned from Vietnam is that you don't fight war just with military power. You fight war with ideas, so you have psychological components to warfare. You fight warfare with economics, and this is the essential component of understanding U.S. leverage in the world today is economic power, particularly in the aftermath of the Cold War.
U.S. foreign policy scholar Jack Nelson Pallmeyer was interviewed by Minneapolis producer Kate Redmond.
Can you envision a world without war?
With the number of people in this world, I feel it's inescapable. You know, and even here, Seattle, Washington, 2-3 weeks ago, kid goes into school, you know, puts a gun on his teacher. It's right in the news.
I work with teenagers, and a lot of them are incredibly intolerant of diversity. I think what it would take is a real commitment within the home to teach tolerance from the very beginning.
Sweat Lodge ceremony is part of an unusual summer camp called Peace Camp, sponsored by the Orlando, Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice. Founders designed the camp to give teenagers, including those who normally wouldn't be able to afford summer camp, an opportunity to spend a week learning about diverse cultures. The camp's primary mission is getting young participants to think about how to create a more peaceful world. The tape was recorded by Orlando actor Bill George. He spoke first with Peace Camp director Dan Horowitz.
We do have the canoeing and swimming that every camp traditionally has, but we also have workshops that deal with issues of multiculturalism, racism, environmental awareness, and specifically a strong emphasis on conflict resolution, on mediation, on how to deal with conflicts in a nonviolent manner.
There are five ground rules that you have to agree to. First of all is you have to be willing to solve the problem. Are you both willing to agree to this?
I'm willing.
Yeah? Okay. You have to listen without interrupting. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. You have to take responsibility for carrying out your agreement.
Uh-huh.
Tell the truth?
Of course.
Yes? Okay. And be respectful. There's no name calling or fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree to that?
Yes.
Okay. Would you like to tell your side of the story, Stephanie?
Okay.
All right, so I bought a new house
before I sold the old one, and I rented the old one out, and the neighbors are all mad because they found out that one of the tenants had AIDS. The lease is signed. I didn't know that he had AIDS, and I can't do anything, and everyone's upset about it, and there's absolutely nothing that can be done.
Excuse me, we've been living here, and we don't want these sick people.
We can't have any interruptions right now. We're just going to have to let Stephanie finish her sudden story, and then you'll get a turn to speak.
Each one of these kids can go back to their school, tell their counselor or their principal that they have been trained in student mediation.
Ellie Canyon is a mediation instructor at the Peace Camp.
That means they can mediate cases like stealing, name-calling, shoving, pushing, that happens in school all the time, and they can mediate between the two sides. And the agreements are reached 90% of the time, and they last all school year 90% of the time. So it's a big help to the counselors to have a student mediator around that can really help, and it changes the atmosphere in the school. This way they solve their own problems, and the atmosphere of the whole school has changed.
So are you willing to take this compromise? Are you willing to go to some kind of support group and learn about the disease? Is that acceptable to you?
Yeah, I guess so.
Is that agreeable solution?
Definitely.
To you? So we need to have you both sign this contract. And
the one thing that mediation deals with is getting the story straight and communication. And that's the major problem in the world, is the communication.
Yeah, everyone has problems. Little kids have problems, teenagers have problems, grown-ups have problems, countries have problems. And I think that just as the group of people gets to be older, gets to be larger, the problems just get to be bigger, but they're about the same basic thing. And the way people solve them is basically has been the same way. And I think through mediation, it'll just totally change the way that people look at their problems.
Whenever we start arguing amongst ourselves, we take what we learned in mediation workshops, and we try to use the rules of fighting fair, and one of us will act as a mediator.
We had something going on at the dinner table the other night, and something came up between sisters. And they both almost said at the same time, well, let's see what the issues are here, you know, maybe it's something that we don't have to, you know, get into each other with. And they asked a consensus of everybody at the table what they thought of what was going on between the two of them, which I thought was really strange. Why would they want everybody else's input? But apparently this is a little technique that they learned here, and they were able to resolve it.
There's a camper here. He's rather young. He's 12 years old, and he's from the inner city of South Florida. And his reality is one of great violence. And so coming to Peace Camp for him was and is a definite change of culture. This is his second camp. The first one he was at was about a month ago. We have two sessions this year. And his attitude then was one of total defiance. And he was the instigator of quite a few violent confrontations with other campers and with a few counselors. But by the end of the week, his way of thinking, I feel, changed so much that he called us up and said that he would raise money in order if he could come back to the second session. So naturally, we let him come back, and we've seen nothing but smiles from him. And that's a definite change, and that's what we're trying to do.
To me, it's just a good place to get away from things at home, all the dividedness and all the rude comments at home and the violence and just things like that. And it's a great place to come and just be with friends and people who you know really care about you.
Like, I've grown emotionally from this camp a lot. And you just learn about how life should really be and how to help social problems and to get to cross the barriers of color and differences and everything. And it's just a really learning experience.
I'm John Kapuki Kikau III. I was born here in Waimea and living on the other side of the island of Kauai. And we're at Poly Holiday PMRF missile range here in Manaa.
This gathering here today at the missile site, what is the importance of this to the Hawaiian movement?
I have nephews, I have cousins, nieces working in this base. It's an economic situation. But I like the base, I like the work, but no missiles. We can avoid that, we'll be all right.
Oh, my name is Mike Grace, and I'm just exercising my native rights. I'll be taking back my land. The military went on to put a missile range over there, and we don't want it on Kauai, yeah, because it's going to destroy the ocean. It's going to make might be a mistake, and then, you know, blow up the island or something like that. So we just don't want it. Yeah. We don't want to be tested like a guinea pig. Yeah? You know, they can do it out in the desert on the mainland, or maybe in front of the White House, you know.
Kauai's PMRF, Pacific Missile Range Facility, lies on land sacred to native Hawaiians. The military has been grooming the site to be a base for Star Wars research. As a result, PMRF has been a focal point in the native struggle to regain land and sovereignty. And now, with the military suffering funding cuts, many Hawaiians are looking at the base as an opportunity to practice economic conversion. Kauai activist Ken Stokes tries to build coalitions between various environmental and peace groups.
There's now early agreement of a need to cast a vision in the community of PMRF as a peacemaking facility. And one of the things that we've started to talk about is that just off Kauai is the world's largest undersea warfare exercise area, which is hardwired with all the best technology. We know every clam and his cousin who moves in that part of the ocean. Let us imagine 10 years out that we are well into a transition to a peacemaking economy. It's not difficult to imagine using all that technology to create at the former PMRF a technology base for ocean research. So right off the top, we think there's a possibility to speak to the West End Hawaiian community about a set of jobs that would not only be secure, but which would probably be more meaningful, and which could even include expanded high-tech kinds of jobs at that facility to do ocean research in a post-Cold War era.
That tape was submitted by middle school teacher David Fisher.
Dismantling the Cold War Economy is a book by Ann Markison and Joel Yudkin. Markison says in the post-Cold War world, the United States should shift its industrial policy from dependence on the military to investments in health, environment, and community stability. Markison was interviewed by Ross Reynolds.
A seawall submarine costs $2 billion. And, you know, the fact of the matter is 10,000 people in southeastern Connecticut are dependent on that, you know, for this, and probably some Boeing workers here indirectly make, you know, avionic equipment and so on for it. So the question is, well, what should we do about these people who would be otherwise be unemployed in 6 months? Well, first of all, I would say, well, imagine that 5 years ago we had said, you, General Dynamics, they have the company that has the prime contract, you will do some alternative use planning now so that when these seawall submarines are finished, we'll have some alternative things for you to do on the site. We've got to start doing this alternative use planning because otherwise we're just going to be held hostage.
Can an industrial policy change that mindset, or are some of these companies simply dinosaurs in the new post-Cold War economy?
Right. I think it could. I mean, my sense from talking to many defense contractors is if they see a market out there, especially a longer-term market, the kind of thing they're good at, designing and developing something, you know, they will go for it. But they have to have some sense that that's where the economy is moving in the longer run. Now, I would also say we don't want to design an industrial policy that only lets the McDonnell Douglases and the Hughes and the Boeings have at it. For instance, there's a very interesting electric car initiative happening in the United States, some small amount of federal government funding. And in the L.A. area, there's a small little company that's been formed called Americon, and they're putting in a bid and trying to, you know, make this prototype car. And GM and Hughes are also teamed up to do an electric car. Here you have two really different designs, a small entrepreneur and the big guys, and who knows will win. Other companies like General Dynamics have an absolute company policy of not doing any alternative use planning, just closing plants, hunkering down, and waiting for the defense budget to go back up.
My name is Wanda Coleman.
And the poem I'm about to share with you was written in July of 1991, and it was published in City Lights Review, the War After War issue, just a few months prior to Los Angeles going up in flames following the verdict in the Rodney King beating trial case. Notes of a Cultural Terrorist. After the war, war begins. War goes on. I am a soldier. Look at my boots, soles worn from seeking work, from hours in unemployment lines. Call me a civilian casualty. The war to feed children. The war to clothe their backs. The war to meet the rent. The war to keep the gas tank full. The war to end the calculated madness keeping the poor poor. What happens to a war deferred? Does it implode? Does repressed aggression ravage the collective soul? There's rioting now. I see the blaze, red smoke rising. The city burns. People are looting, taking things. All the excess denied them. Crimes of possession to have without the onus of color or fear of rejection. Children carry racks of clothes. Women push shopping carts brimming with food. Men seem to favor liquor stores and gun shops. But what we need is revolution, bloodless or otherwise. We must go deeper than lust gratified in one spontaneous, torrid upsurge of rage. I am a soldier. Look at my hair, fallen out under stress. The many hours unappreciated on the job, not even a decent chair. Call me collateral damage. And when all the foreign battles are won, when all the foreign battles are won, will we who battled here at home have our day in democracy's sun? We sat in the bar in late afternoon trying to figure out where all the men had gone, the ones who weren't dead or in jail, who loved women, the ones who weren't junkies, weren't alcoholics, weren't already married, the ones who love our color. And one sister took a tall swig and said she'd be satisfied if she lived to see her refrigerator full just once before she departs this planet.
Los Angeles poet Wanda Coleman was taped by Vanessa May.
That's the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Don't forget, this is your program, too. We invite you to take part in Earth on the Air's ongoing radio dialogue.
Find out about becoming a member of the Earth on the Air Radio Works and receive a copy of our submission guidelines.
Write us at P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
Earth on the Air Submissions Director is Susan Gleason. Our Executive Director is Craig McDonald. The show is produced and edited by Peter Mulloff and Suzanne Tedesco and engineered by Eric Bowerman.
We had additional help from Loel Harvey, Janet Hurt, Mike Riley, Peter Young, Spencer Ante, and Claire Cavanaugh.
Also thanks to KUOW, Alex Sergienko and Associates, and the Dub Train Cassette Duplicating Services in Seattle.
Music was from David Affalter, Jim Page, Artist the Spoon Man, Joe Marshalla, Roland Barker, David Hines, and Randy.
Production facilities provided by Jackstraw Productions in Seattle.
Partial funding was from the Town Creek Foundation, the Dudley Foundation, and the Mary Reynolds Babcock Foundation.
If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-800-3145. Mention that you'd like program number 27. For the Earth on the Air Radio Works, this is Janice Kane.
And I'm Peter Mulloff.